Welcome to The Tide, the radio show and podcast of the Halifax Media Co-op. I'm Erica Butler. On this first episode of The Tide, we hear from Gerald Hannon, elder statesman of the Canadian Gay Liberation Movement. Harsha Walia, known as a legal co-founder and author of Undoing Border Imperialism. And last but not least, Miles Howe, Halifax Media Co-op journalist, editor, and anti-fracking activist. Thanks for joining us on The Tide, and remember to check out halifax.mediacoop.ca for more stories from the grassroots. There's a few reasons you might have heard of Gerald Hannon. He's an award-winning journalist, former Ryerson professor, former sex worker, gay rights activist, and former writer for The Body Politic, the Toronto-based monthly, which played a key role in Canada's gay liberation movement in the 70s and 80s. Gerald was in Halifax in November to talk about his part in the history of the queer rights movement in Canada. The Halifax Media Co-op's Mark Rendell was there and has kindly agreed to tell us about it. Welcome to The Tide, Mark.
Hi.
So Gerald Hannon has a lot of stories to tell. He was at the epicenter of the gay liberation movement in Toronto, witnessed some very key moments. One of those is the bathhouse raids in Toronto in 1981.
Absolutely, yeah. So there'd been a number of bathhouse raids before, which had met a little bit of protest from kind of the activist community in Toronto, but nothing like the response to the bathhouse raids on the night of February 5th, 1981. Gerald was working really late in the Body Politic magazine. Then he got a call from a taxi driver friend saying, "You have to come see this." So he hopped in the taxi, and here's a clip of Gerald talking about what he saw.
It was scary when we got there. We went to every bath on our well-known list of baths, and there was a police car outside every one of them, a panic wagon outside several of them, and men were being shoved at the door and shoved into the back. And, I still get emotional at that. So, a horrible scene, anyway.
Clearly quite an emotional thing for him to talk about it. But really inspirational, him speaking about kind of what happened next. So at the time, Body Politic was one of the few gay organizations in the city that had multiple phone lines. And they started calling out everybody they knew and managed somehow to get a hold of enough people and organize a meeting for the next day.
And we debated what we should do. And there were two proposals. One was do nothing except take the media on a tour of the baths to show how violent the police had been, and they had. They'd brought in crowbars and sledgehammers and smashed the places to shit. So that was one proposal. The other proposal was that we should actually react, and we should do it that night, even though the chances of organizing it seems slight. But that's the one we voted for. It was a collective response.
They started putting out posters all across Toronto saying, "Meet at midnight in the corner of Wesley and Yonge." And Gerald said when he first showed up on the corner, there were the usual activists, you know, several dozen. And then as the time went on, half an hour later, there were all of a sudden hundreds of people. An hour later, there was thousands and thousands of people.
What was happening that was happening kind of below the surface was that the community was actually coalescing in ways that don't always strike politicos, right? I mean, there were gay baseball teams, there were lesbian softball teams, there were people who got together to play cards, there were, you know, all that stuff that just actually how community functions a lot. And that, I think, A, the Body Politic helped engender, but it was also just self-creating. The world began to self-create itself in ways that we couldn't even quite have imagined back in the day. And those were the people who turned up. I mean, you know, we had our 150 activists there, but that wouldn't have been anywhere near enough and would have been shaming. I mean, it took a community well on the rise and well shaping itself into a force to get out there and do something, and it never looked back as far as I can see.
Gerald Hannon's talk was not without its tense moments here in Halifax. Can you describe the scene when the topic of race came into the discussion?
Gerald was talking about how it was easier to organize in the 1970s and 80s. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that young people weren't facing as dire economic situations as I think a lot of young people today are. Some people in the audience, you know, mentioned the fact, well, it was easy for you because you were a white male. Gerald's response was, well, in the movement, we were all white men. some people got quite upset with that comment. So here's Gerald in reaction to some of the comments.
When the body politics started, 95% of the city was European white. Mm-hmm. I scarcely knew a person of color in those days. And, you know, it's not as if we consciously excluded anyone. We would have accepted anyone who wanted to fight for gay rights. But the thing was, and I sometimes have to say this, gay liberation in Toronto was started by middle-class young white guys. You know, it's just the way it was. I won't be made to feel guilty about being white and organizing with other white guys. I'm sorry.
What were the reactions to Gerald's unapologetic description of the way he experienced gay liberation in Toronto in the 70s?
Well, the reactions were quite mixed. There were people who appreciated his honesty, who said there's no point in trying to place people into narratives simply because today it's politically correct to try to get this more pluralistic representation. But some people were quite upset with his comments. Two people actually walked out in response to it. And their concern was with the question of who's not being heard if we focus exclusively on Gerald's narrative of gay white men leading the liberation movement. Where were women in the movement? Where were trans people in the movement? Where were people of color as well? Mm-hmm. And so the question is there a problem when we just hear people like Gerald talk? Who's not being represented in this narrative of gay activism? After the talk, I spoke with Evan Cool of Solidarity Halifax, and he was one of the hosts and one of the people that was that had organized the talk. And here's what he had to say about underrepresentation of people of color in the gay activist movement, even here in Halifax.
I think it's unfair to put that solely on the queer community because Halifax is a very segregated, like it's culturally, socially, economically, and even geographically segregated still. And the queer community reflects that. I mean, honestly, I think we can be doing more. I don't know what that looks like, but I think the queer community has to get serious about dealing with racism.
It's interesting that what is essentially a talk on our history ends up focusing so much on present-day attitudes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the reason behind Solidarity Halifax, the organization of the People's History Conference. It's based on the idea that we need to know the history of the activist communities, minority communities, people who aren't really represented in the history textbooks that we get in class. And it was mentioned by several people that there's often not this intergenerational communication. But Gerald said he's noticed a big change in people's interest in the history of the gay rights movement.
I mean, I get so many requests from young people for interviews these days, people who, and it's kind of exhilarating, you know, going from old fart to being old wise man is quite a transformation. But I mean, it's really kind of, it's exhilarating for me to see that that period is not only not buried, but people are digging it up and people are fascinated by it. And I tend not to answer questions for advice because I say, listen, it's your world. I don't live in it, really. I don't know how to handle it. I don't tweet, you know. You guys have to work, you guys have to figure out what the issues are and do, you know, devise your own schemes. If I could use Grindr, I probably would. But, you know, you surrender certain things after a certain point.
So that was writer and gay rights activist Gerald Hannon, who spoke in Halifax in November. Mark Rendell, thanks for sharing this with us.
And you're more than welcome. Thanks a lot.
Coming up later on The Tide, we hear firsthand from Media Co-op journalist Miles Howe, who's been arrested 3 times while covering the conflict over shale gas exploration in El Sabuktuk. Questions for Miles Howe.
I have answers for you, Erica.
Harsha Walia is a South Asian activist, writer, and popular educator based in Vancouver, Coast Salish Territories. She is co-founder of No One Is Illegal, the grassroots migrant justice group that works to combat everything from deportations to racial profiling to exploitative working conditions of migrants. Harsha Walia works at the Downtown Eastside Women's Center in one of Canada's poorest postal codes. Naomi Klein has called her one of Canada's most brilliant and effective political organizers. This October, Harsha Walia released Undoing Border Imperialism, part textbook, part handbook, Undoing Border Imperialism not only outlines the best work of Known as Illegal, but builds an understanding of settler colonialism that puts borders at the core of our systems of oppression. Candida Hadley is an editor at Fernwood Publishing and contributor to the Halifax Media Co-op. She spoke with Harsha Walia in Halifax in November. She started off asking Harsha about how the fight for Indigenous sovereignty figures into her work on migrant issues and other social justice movements.
All, if not most, movements have ignored Indigenous sovereignty. I think it's central to organize our movements in solidarity with Indigenous struggles, and to do so in a way that isn't about optional alliance, but it's to actually understand that we can't have any social or environmental justice movement that doesn't deal with the reality of settler colonialism, because every system of oppression is organized, within Canada at least, around settler colonialism. So if we look at poverty, poverty is deliberate in the settler colonial context. Indigenous communities face deliberate impoverishment. It's not a coincidence. Patriarchy within settler colonialism is organized around, you know, the destruction of Indigenous nationhood and the destruction of Indigenous families and the deliberate targeting of Indigenous women. Obviously, land destruction, environmental degradation is also part and parcel of settler colonialism. So we start to see that various seemingly diverse issues and seemingly diverse social movements can actually strengthen themselves by understanding settler colonialism as a pillar of all of these forms of oppression. You know, of course, a lot of migrant communities, not all, but a lot of migrant communities come with a deep history of colonialism and capitalism. Often these aren't in settler colonial contexts. So it looks differently and it's organized differently, but certainly there's a legacy of colonialism. So for me, you know, being away from home, one of the ways in which I imagine myself as fighting kind of colonialism globally is very much to be rooted in a local struggle against colonialism. I think a lot of migrants can feel and understand that. You know, of course, the responsibility, which is on all people, to align ourselves with anti-colonial struggles on Turtle Island and to understand the ways in which we're complicit and, you know, and hence we become responsible.
Feminism is another sort of topic that's important in your work. And you had mentioned, when you were talking about the Indigenous struggles, you had mentioned patriarchy and the role. And I was wondering if you could just expand on that a little bit.
Feminism needs to, like, really urgently reimagine itself. And so, you know, there's certainly the waves of feminism that have been critiqued for, you know, being primarily white and middle class and being really colonial in their conceptions of feminism. So this idea that feminism means equality for women, and equality for women is prescribed to achieving greater economic success and is essentially about being accommodated and achieving gains within capitalism and colonialism, for example. But even within, you know, what people imagine as a radical feminism or third wave feminism or a post-colonial feminism or all these different kind of labels, even within those forms of feminism, I think there's a lot lacking, because those forms of feminism understand anti-oppression, for example. So then, you know, the necessity to include the leadership of women of color, of poor women, of trans women, of Indigenous women, of single mothers, etc. And so in the context of colonialism, for example, you know, patriarchy is organized in deep connection with violence against the land. Yet feminism has not articulated the relationship between settler colonialism and patriarchy as organized around dispossession of land, and how colonialism very much deliberately targets Indigenous women and Indigenous women's bodies, not simply as a form of patriarchy, but also as a form of colonialism. Because dispossessing women from the land means removing the front line of defense from the land. But again, without understanding how actually capitalism is organized through patriarchy, and that the very kind of conception of capital accumulation is rooted in an understanding of a fundamentally anti-communitarian social organization of labor, which sounds like a lot of jargon, but we can, you know, look at examples like reproductive labor or domestic labor, all these forms of labor that have traditionally been carried by women in their communities and continue to be carried by women in their communities, but are not recognized as labor. because both of patriarchy, but also of capitalism, because capitalism only values that as labor which can be commodified and can be privatized. And these forms of labor are fundamentally rooted in community, which is what capitalism aims to destroy through privatization and forms of social isolation. So, you know, those are just some examples of how I think feminism has not yet articulated a deeper understanding of how patriarchy is actually organized as not just something that's about violence against women or lack of equality between genders, but actually as organized through various forms of domination and oppression. So oftentimes, you know, struggles of women of color are seen as, you know, intersectional, right? I think actually intersectionality is not something that's helpful in some ways, because it means that we don't understand how things aren't just crossing each other, they're actually organized through each other. I think big F feminism has understood maybe the need to incorporate more voices, but not understood the deep ways in which these systems actually inform each other. So I'm a member of the Feb 14th Women's Memorial March Committee. And, you know, now, for example, there's an increasing awareness of the ways in which issues affecting missing and murdered Indigenous women in particular needs to be a part of a core part of the feminist movement, and that this is a form of violence against women, but it, you know, has its specific contours as kind of colonial gendered violence. But, you know, there's also the deep reality that in the context of Vancouver, for example, this march has been going on now for 23 years. And so it's taken decades to even get a basic amount of recognition, if you will, let alone a deep commitment in action.
That was author Harsha Walia in conversation with Candida Hadley in Halifax this November. You can hear the full interview online this January at halifax.mediacoop.ca. You're listening to the Tide podcast and radio show produced by the Halifax Media Co-op. In our final feature on this edition of the Tide, we hear from Halifax Media Co-op editor and writer Miles Howe. The thumper trucks and shothole drillers of Swin International have left the Elsabuktuk First Nation in New Brunswick after completing their most recent round of seismic testing with the help of two Korten junctions. Swin was looking for shale gas deposits deep underground of Elsabuktuk territory, deposits that, if substantial, Swin plans to harvest by the controversial method of fracking. Miles Howe has been covering the conflict over Swin's seismic testing for 6 months, occasionally becoming involved by vocally opposing the testing and volunteering evidence in a New Brunswick court. I spoke with him recently about his experience in Elsabuktuk.
Miles, the conflict in Elsabuktuk has been going on since the summer. Can you take us back a bit?
I think really what happened, the first sort of physical on-the-ground contact or confrontation, let's call it, was right at the end of May, beginning of June, when a Stantec water testing truck was seized at the Wilson's gas station on the reserve itself proper. I believe that truck was taken to the RCMP station in Elsabuktuk and was then returned to Stantec by the RCMP. A few days later, two people got arrested, one of them rather violently. She was holding an eagle staff and a drum. Her arms were twisted back. She did suffer some ligament damage to her left arm, left wrist. Beginning of June, there were several more arrests, people out on the highway. One woman was praying and was, you know, picked up and taken away. Middle of June, National Aboriginal Day, by coincidence, 12 more people were arrested. Prior to the raid that, I guess the raid heard around the world, or
that's the October 17th one, yeah.
Right. There was probably about 40 arrests going on over the course of the summer also.
Who has been protesting?
From varying degrees on the ground or on the front lines, I will safely say that it's been largely First Nations people. Behind the scenes in terms of signing letters, petitions, there's been, you know, a variety of groups. You began to see an increased Acadian and rural Anglophone presence there as well. So it's been an interesting kind of melding and, you know, unions of a variety of backgrounds, cultures. In terms of the representation, it's been largely First Nations led. But there's been several million dollars in, I believe it's about $47 million invested by this company, SWN, into the province. A recent figure just came out that they've already spent $4.3 million on policing of these protests. From all that money, take it as you will,
there's a serious investment that's been made on this. There's contracts that have been signed. There's penalties for going back on that. So I guess the reasoning behind stopping it where it is right now is that if it gets to the point where they are, you know, beginning to drill well pads, etc., if you're seeing the security and the push that's going on now just for them to be able to test, at the point that it becomes a true drilling project, it might be, you know, arguably too late to stop.
What are people concerned about when they hear that these trucks are coming to do seismic exploration, to eventually do fracking for shale gas?
Well, it's a very water-intensive process to begin with, right? I believe it's 10 to 30 million gallons of water per well, and that's mixed with a variety of chemicals that are still under, I believe, patent, so we're not, you know, quite sure what's even going into that water that's injected under high pressure into the earth. And then that water generally comes back up pre-gas. So what do you do with that dirty water? So it becomes, you know, are you first, where are you going to get that water? Is there enough water to go around between animals, people, the environment that depends on that water, plus the industry that's looking for that water? Is there enough to go around? Then what do you do with that water once it's poisoned? Nova Scotia has just said that they're not going to accept any more frack waste water from New Brunswick or anywhere else while there's a moratorium here. Then there's the question of what do those pipes do when you're drilling down? What are you breaking through? Because it is, you know, it's a very intensive process. So what are you breaking through aquifers? As you break into shale, is gas coming up through the shale, getting into aquifers? Are you draining natural aquifers? Are you poisoning them with methane gas? There's two means in which this company is testing right now. There's one that is the thumper trucks, Vibriosis trucks. And normally what they do is they go in a line, I believe in a minimum of three. And they're fairly large, sort of like dump truck size trucks with pads that will descend down from them and send, you know, vibrations into the earth. And there'll be a line of equipment, batteries plus geophones, strung along the highway wherever they're working. And if you get up close to them, it literally does shake the ground where you are. Then you've also got the more invasive technique of shot hole drilling, which is done with generally when the roads accommodate it, like dirt roads, sizable enough. You've got these tank treaded devices that can go into, you know, far more woodsy areas than you might expect. They can really kind of trailblaze. And what happens is these things have about a 10 meter long drill bit on the back of them. They drill down into the ground. An explosive charge is set into there. And then those charges are set off. And then the geophones pick up the same information through the shockwaves that are sent out. And I, you know, from what I can understand is that there's not much in the way of governmental monitoring of this situation. I've made requests from the Department of Energy and Mines, from Natural Resources, from the Environment. And so far, nobody's gotten back to me in terms of who or what department is actually monitoring or following up on what kind of damage these shot hole tests might be causing. So, you know, I'm going to assume that the only sort of self-monitoring that's going on is from a company aspect, or from literally from, call it what you will, protectors, protesters, activists who are actually going back into the woods and finding, for example, broken shot holes where, you know, that are left open, aquifers spilling out that are broken, iron deposits oxidizing in the air and, you know, causing a general mess of the forest that certainly wasn't there beforehand.
There was an injunction sought in a court in Moncton, and you decided to intervene in that process.
From my research, what I had found is that, you know, first, the broken aquifers was a fairly, I thought it was very important for a judge to take into consideration for a variety of reasons. First, because it did break the Oil and Natural Gas Act, because the company had not reported that in a proper manner, which displayed some sense of irresponsibility on their part. But more importantly, perhaps, what I thought the key to that argument might be, or at least that the judge might want to consider, is that it was David Allward's. David Allward is the premier, but he's also the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs in New Brunswick. So it was Allward's Aboriginal Affairs Secretariat that had gone through a determination based on SWN-provided information that during the seismic testing phase, damage to Aboriginal traditional use of territory would be negligible. So my thought was, this is something you might want to consider as a judge, that perhaps this is not negligible damage.
And so the best way to get that, I mean, I guess the only way you sought to get that to the judge's attention.
You know, I certainly didn't want to open myself up to a lawsuit from the fifth largest gas company in North America. Like, that wasn't the point. The point was to present information that I felt was objective.
So that injunction did get granted to SWN. And then a few days after that, your third arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea why, you know, you have been arrested three times now?
I don't think they necessarily know what to do with me, is the reality of it. I'm not sure I'm being targeted per se. I think each arrest is kind of an individual thing. I would chalk it up to being harassed on that aspect. They've come to my house in Halifax looking to find me. They've, masqueraded as not introducing themselves as RCMP to a variety of people in order to, you know, establish my whereabouts or find my phone number. They've pulled me over while I've been in cars, you know, pulled cars over and, you know, wanted to speak only to me. They've offered me money to inform or find out who lit the fire. For the October 17th raid, I was just there. You know, I was acting in no other capacity other than a journalist. I was just simply did not say a word. I was quite scared that, you know, somebody was going to die because there was, you know, probably about 60 guns trained on us. You know, these were trained men, but in the same sense, it was a very, very difficult situation to be in. So I just stood there snapping photos. When the cops did attack, somebody, you know, screamed, "Get him, he's with them." And then I got tackled to the ground and, you know, arrested again and then was later released without charge. I think this is just sort of an example of police not necessarily enjoying that there is a perspective that's being presented. They act racist, they say racist things, they arrest Indigenous people and push non-Indigenous people to the side, they kick people when they're down, they punch elders in the face. And these are all things that I've seen. You know, they've shot people with less lethal rounds when they weren't even, you know, necessarily a danger. They've acted in a very, very brutal and dangerous manner. So having that, they probably hate me. But in the same sense, I still think I'm doing my job.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today, Miles.
You're very welcome, Erica. It was a pleasure.
As of December 20th, 2013, Miles Howe is still awaiting the return of his phone and camera from the New Brunswick RCMP, and the broken aquifer that Miles documented is still seeping onto the forest floor. SWN International says they will be back in Elsabooktuk in 2015. To keep abreast of events in Elsabooktuk, check out halifax.mediacoop.ca, where you can listen to the full interview with Miles Howe and check out his coverage of the movement against fracking in New Brunswick. Thanks for listening to The Tide, the podcast and radio show of the Halifax Media Co-op. This episode of The Tide was produced in Halifax by Erica Butler and Pierre Loisel, with contributions from Candida Hadley and Mark Rendell. For more information on stories you hear on The Tide, check out halifax.mediacoop.ca, where you can also subscribe to The Tide podcast.